Welcome, members and guests, to the October 10 program of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon's Geology. Scientists warn of hazards, but do lawmakers and agencies respond? Thank you for joining us. Greetings to our broadcast television and radio audience. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President. Our City Club sponsors for today are Network Charter School, a standards-based, hands-on public school for students in grades 7 to 12, Hearing Associates, Dr. Gail Leslie, Dr. Sandy Ibarra, and Dr. Brad Smith, and KLCC, NPR for Western and Central Oregon. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the broadcasts. We also want to thank the Lane County Department of Health and Human Services for hosting teachers this past week who are participating in the healthcare career course we are sponsoring with Lane Workforce Partnership and the Lane Educational Service District. We're very pleased today to welcome our new members, Nathan Phillips and Paul Markoff. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please consider becoming a City Club donor, sponsor, regular, or virtual member. And now, our program coordinator for this look at Oregon geology and land use laws, Randy Prince.
Today, the City Club welcomes two women who have worked hard to see that when it comes to staying safe, Oregonians will act on what we know about natural hazards, both in government and as individuals. Our program today is a follow-up to one in July, where the City Club learned what happened in Oso, Washington, the site of the deadliest landslide in U.S. history. We heard there were warnings of danger well before a hillside gave way, but not enough was done before it was too late. Today we ask, is Oregon doing enough to respond to warnings delivered in our state? For years now, we've heard of the great earthquake that will come to our region. And earlier this year, the Department of Geology and Minerals released a database of landslide risks, one that was developed with the latest technology and includes information about hazard areas here in Lane County. For most of us who have never seen a devastating earthquake or a huge landslide in person, let us consider how we react when we see a disaster on television. There's some voice in our head saying, "Don't worry, it's only a movie." Or some other voice saying, "Don't think about these bad things. That'll just make them more likely to happen." Or is it our wallet talking to us saying, there's so much to do and not nearly enough money? In spite of these temptations to be led astray, there is work being done to address the dangers. The Oregon Resilience Plan is the primary document guiding preparations for the big earthquake. It was begun in 2011 and finished last year. The plan was prepared by a task force of the Oregon State Seismic Policy Advisory Committee, that's OSPAC, and delivered to the Oregon Legislature. The principal scientific agency advising the task force was the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, or DOGAMI. Our first speaker, Dr. Vicki McConnell, is agency executive for DOGAMI and holds the title of state geologist. Her career includes 3 decades of study of volcanoes and volcanic hazards. From her first helicopter landing on the dome of Mount St. Helens in 1983, she's been fascinated by the power of geologic processes and how humans respond to those processes. 2 ongoing personal goals of Dr. McConnell have been to demystify science for the general public of all ages through good communication and in showing how scientific information is important for everyone on a day-to-day basis. She received her bachelor's in geology and land use in 1983 from the Metropolitan State College in Denver, Colorado, and her PhD in geology and volcanology from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1996. And then, responding from the legislator's perspective, we'll hear from Deborah Boone, who has served as House District 32's representative since 2004. Originally from Portland, she lives in Clatsop County on the northern Oregon coast, where she's held jobs as county commissioner, restaurant owner, construction company owner, adult educator, and legislative assistant. Her 2 bachelor's degrees are in art and psychology. Representative Boone served on OSPAC, the advisory committee, and in 2011, she introduced House Resolution 3, which was unanimously approved and authorized preparation of the Oregon Resilience Plan. And now we'll hear from Dr. McConnell.
Well, thank you, everyone, very much. I'm so honored to be here. I really thank you, Eugene City Club, and it's nice to see all these folks that have come out and want to hear a little bit about what we are and aren't doing when it comes to dealing with hazards and hazard mitigation. I also want to thank Representative Boone, who is a real champion for emergency preparedness of all shapes and manners, and it's a real honor to be here, and it's an honor to share a panel discussion with her today. Thanks so much. So I'm going to start by saying all is not lost, and I'm going to answer the question of the title of the talk today. Remember, that is, scientists warn of hazards, but do lawmakers and agencies respond? Well, my answer is sometimes, but not in a well-thought-out manner. Good progress has been made by the state and local governances toward developing communities and resources in a way that's smarter and safer. However, as a state, we need to be more focused on realizable goals and comprehensive in our hazards mitigation. We can only do that if we're willing to step up and invest in mitigation and community resilience. So I want to step back a little bit and talk about DOGAMI, Department of Geology and Mineral Industry, and how we fit into the picture for hazards and natural hazard mitigation. Our mission is to provide earth science information and regulation to make Oregon safe and prosperous. We do that through a whole variety of things. We make maps, we deal with reports and data that help Oregon manage their natural resources and prepare for natural hazards. And we do have hazards. Let me give you a list of them. Earthquakes, tsunamis, landslides, floods, volcanoes, and coastal erosion among them. I just thought I'd name the high ones there. And I want to mention also, being a geologist, and I would never let you out of here without a little bit of a geology lesson, is that those same processes that we work on as natural hazards are exactly what caused the incredible landscape and landforms that we have in this state. So, well, yeah, you worry about that volcano erupting. The fact that we have those Cascade volcanoes, that shapes everything from our climate to our tourism. We manage and prepare for natural hazards, and we do that through assessing what the hazards are, where our communities are vulnerable, and promoting risk reduction strategies so our communities can become resilient. So what does that mean? What do we do in practice? Well, first, what are the hazards? We can't get ready for a natural hazard if we don't know where they are and what the extent of the impact will be on the communities and our state. So some of our initial tasks are to identify and characterize geologic hazards across the state and the region and make all those data both useful and informative to everyone. That work alone takes considerable time and research capacity for DOGAMI geoscientists and our partners in state and federal agencies and our partners in academia. We use the best science and the most innovative technology. For example, we're constantly pushing the boundaries to see into the earth and see the earth. And we do that through cutting-edge remote sense technologies like LIDAR-derived digital elevation data. I'm sure you heard something about that when you had the OSO landslide talk. Or looking at three-dimensional modeling of the Earth's subsurface. I will note that the state does appropriate a modest amount of funds to accomplish this work, but we're challenged to be able to find federal and other funds to leverage those funds. Next, we have to come to grips with community vulnerability. If there were no people or places we cared about that would be devastated by an earthquake, then it would really only be of academic interest that that particular fault has failed over the last 10,000 years. But when that fault runs directly through a downtown, such as the Portland Hills fault does, or along the entire coastline, like the Cascadia subduction zone fault does, then we become concerned about the vulnerability of our communities. This has become more crucial over the last several decades as our population and our human activities tend to grow and expand and get us into geographic areas that tend to be more prone for hazards, and as we better understand the geology and the landforms around us. So determining community vulnerability requires compiling data and information about the people, infrastructure, the land uses, and the potential changes into the future. We research data such as land uses, zoning, tax lots, building inventories, population, and population forecasts, and then we incorporate those data with known geologic hazards so that we can develop models of damage and loss under a variety of scenarios or what-ifs. For example, we developed a series of vulnerability models and loss estimates to compare the losses to Sandy River Valley communities due to Mount Hood volcanic hazards. Those hazards include earthquakes, floods, lahars and mud flows, pyroclastic flows, landslides and debris flows. These models take into consideration the actual building types and the building stock in the communities at this time, thus allowing us to put real comparative values to the losses and estimates of what it would take to recover. This is vital information for communities as they work on planning for preparedness and recovery. It was interesting and really not expected what we found, that the annualized cost of losses from volcano-derived lahars and pyroclastic flows, which would be those rare, catastrophic, but very infrequent actual eruptions from Mount Hood, far exceeded the annualized costs from more frequent flooding hazards that happen on the Sandy River nearly every year. So what does that mean? Well, it means that you as a community really should be thinking about how to mitigate for something that is likely to only occur every 500 years if you really want to have a recovery and a recoverable economy. So there's really no kicking the can down the road. Finally, we promote risk reduction strategies. We do that by cooperating with federal and state emergency preparedness agencies and governments at all levels so that we can develop mitigation strategies for Oregon communities. This includes affecting how we build, how we live and develop, and how we prepare to respond and recover from inevitable natural disasters. I want to stress that we do not have the capacity to carry on this work through any kind of comprehensive program, and most of the projects that we work on are funded through federal disaster response funds. In other words, after the fact. There have been, and there continue to be, genuine and thoughtful efforts and attempts by lawmakers and agencies to take on fully comprehensive and proactive actions to mitigate for hazards. The results have been mixed. As an example, I'm going to give you a history of a landslide hazard mitigation program attempt. After the thousands of landslides and five fatalities associated with the debris flows during the winter storms of 1996-97, the legislature convened a landslide hazard task force. The task force met with landslide experts, reviewed issues in the field, and looked at policy. They made several recommendations about hazard characterization, real estate disclosure, and land use mitigation, and some of those recommendations were incorporated into law in 1999. The bill that was introduced then, Senate Bill 12, tasked several agencies with actions for mitigating landslides, tasked my agency, Dogami, to identify areas that were potentially prone to debris flows, only debris flows, directed the Department of Land Conservation and Development to assist local government with implementation of land use changes based on those areas that we identified in our map, required the Board of Forestry to provide technical assistance to local governments, tasked the Department of Transportation to cooperatively develop geographically specific debris flow warning systems, and directed the Office of Emergency Management to effectively respond to landslide emergencies. Local governments were required to regulate development in areas identified as landslide prone based on these maps. The siting of dwellings designed for human occupancy in these areas of what's called rapidly moving landslides would be severely restricted, and a moratorium on any building in those areas would go into effect as soon as the maps that we produced were adopted. One-time appropriation of funds were directed to the state agencies. Taken collectively, all of these actions could have helped the communities to become less vulnerable and reduce risk, and this was statewide. But ultimately, the legislation and its goals and products were not successful because of a myriad of factors. First, the scope was too narrow. Focus was on loss of life only. It did not address all landslide hazards. The continued loss of property due to landslide hazards has only increased since 1999 on an annual basis. Best technology wasn't available. In 1999, the state did not have remote sensing technology and LIDAR elevation data that's really essential for accurately inventorying, mapping, and modeling landslide risk and susceptibility. That information has only become available since 2005 and the inception of the Oregon LIDAR Consortium. Tools needed for change weren't in place. Land use mitigation and planning tools were not in place to actually implement land use development siting changes that were required by the statutes, and as such put a huge burden and expense on local governances. Debris flow science still isn't there. There's still insufficient debris flow monitoring science to effectively put together and maintain a debris flow warning system. Thus, ODOT was constrained in what they could develop and the usefulness of that information. There was a lack of ongoing funds. Funding was not identified or appropriate to maintain these efforts. In other words, this was considered a one-time fix, not a comprehensive statewide plan, and with realizable goals and objectives and a way forward to actually get to those goals and objectives. But all's not lost. Each agency that I mentioned has initiated landslide hazard mitigation actions, bits and pieces, and they continue to do so. We have not been able to focus our goals nor tackle the problem in a comprehensive manner because we do not have the dedicated funds or the achievable mandates. We strive for informed decision-making and forward-thinking mitigation actions, but it doesn't come fast or cheap. We are all in this for the long run, and we even have new issues looming on the horizon. While we can debate about the hows and whats and wherefores regarding climate change, the fact is the climate is changing, and we need to factor in adaptation to a new climate. This will bring challenges and opportunities, but it's going to change the natural playing field that defines the land, the resources, our communities, and the impact of the hazards to all of us. I stated in the beginning that this talk that we, as a state, need to be more focused on realizable goals and comprehensive in our hazards mitigation. We can only do that if we're willing to really step up, invest in mitigation and community resilience, and not always be in the reactive mode. Thank you very much.
That's going to be a hard act to follow. Hi, and thank you for putting up with me today. I'm the stand-in. I'm not Senator Roblin. I'm Representative Deborah Boone. I represent the Upper Left Coast, the beautiful Upper Left Coast today. And I'm here because I want to support this outreach that we're starting to do, a little more outreach. And this is definitely not in my coastal thought process, but this is important to spread this out. This is a statewide resilience plan that she, Dr. McConnell, referenced, and I will address that, just to let you know, that was my part in it. I have the degree in psychology and art, which I use every day in the legislature, but it she's the scientific expert, and she's absolutely a delight to work with. She boils it down to plain speak, which I think is very much appreciated, unless you're a scientist and then you're, you know, whatever, but you understand everything anyway. I'll give you a tiny little background on this, the resilience plan. I started 8 years ago on the Emergency Preparedness Committee, and that committee has had several permutations over the years. So it's been conjoined by, it's been a joint committee with the Senate House, and it's been a joint committee with Ocean Policy. It's been it's currently with Veterans now. So it's an interesting committee, and I chaired and I've co-chaired and I've vice-chaired, and so right now I'm just a member, which is fine with me. because I can get a lot of work done with people like Dr. McConnell to tap into. Just like our veterans have always had the back, we call them the back row, the vets, the department heads, and anybody else in between, we have our regulars in committee, and it's very much appreciated that they take the time to attend our committees during session. So a couple years ago, well, in 2011, a couple people approached me. One was a constituent of mine, and one was Ted Wolf, who's not, but very much involved with schools and seismic retrofits in Portland. And he was friends with my constituent, and they came to me and said, would you please introduce a resilience bill? And I thought, what? What is that? And they had to inform me of what this was. And we'd been starting to hear about the Cascadia event in committee, starting with Dr. Chris Goldfinger from Oregon State University, who heads up the mapping lab, seafloor mapping lab, and then other maps too. But that was what we were talking about at the time. And when we asked him, why did you need to map the bottom of the ocean, there's a lot of reasons, but one of which was to develop some credible tsunami models, because they start out at sea and it depends on how the water moves, how to get, I mean, here's this part that's talking, the artist talking, but anyway, we need it. And we needed what Dr. McConnell's shop was doing with the LIDAR. It was a good mix because we took care of under the water as it came onto land, then she picked it up with the LIDAR, and then we felt comfortable that we were getting some credible tsunami models of the inundation zones, which have changed over the years. And so much to the consternation of builders, et cetera, and homeowners on the coast, you think you're out of the woods and you're not. You find out that it's really going to be much higher. So it seemed like the right time to do this. In Japan, they have been about 50 years ahead of where we are now, you know, concurrently down the road. So when they have their disasters, they're much more prepared than we are. And so we've taken a hard look and a good lesson from them, inviting them over to help us craft what this, you can see it's about an inch thick. This is the Oregon Resilience Plan. This was the product of a committee of 170 people, and who worked over a year. They boiled that big plan down to this summary, which is about 8 pages. There were 8 subcommittees of all the sectors that you would think, the usual telecommunications, energy, transportation, water, and water systems, et cetera, that would be affected by earthquakes. And we built it around an earthquake. But there's a coastal component that addresses tsunami, too. And then this 8-page plan was just recently by the implementation task force for this plan boiled down to 2 pages. I mean, we even got into lowering the size of the font just to get it all in. So you can't read it without a magnifying glass. But this is all available, lucky for us and lucky for the technology sector. It's on the websites, on her website, on Oregon Emergency Management. And you can find these at oregon.gov. That's the starting point, and then you can search from there. And I was happy to do this as a first step in what Dr. McConnell said. I mean, I could be up here defending a legislator, you know, why we were not doing this, and it costs money, et cetera, and I hear it all the time. And we are locked in arms on this one. We need to do this, we need to fund it, and we need to do it now. And we need to get the word out so that people like you, even if you live inland, it's going to affect you too, because what if you're at the beach when it happens? So our coastal communities have come a long way. They've come from the chambers of commerce saying, oh, no, don't tell people about this. You know, they won't come. And so, no, we need to tell them, because when they come, and they do come, and think about Hood to Coast and some of the events when you get thousands of people at the coast, they need to know what to do, where to go. And in our coastal communities, we have groups of volunteers who've worked for several years now building their own community plans, which include evacuation routes. And in Cannon Beach, for example, they even have caches where people buy, and it's probably about as big as this lectern, it's like a big drum, and they fill it with supplies. And every 6 months, they turn the stuff that times out. And you know, being Cannon Beach, it's usually a party. So let's have a, you know, a bin turning party or whatever. But they just had an event, and both Dr. McConnell and I were on the beach. I didn't do the run, she did. But we all met at the top of the hill where the caches are kept, and there was a little ceremony, et cetera. And it was very good to see. I think there were 75 people who partook in that particular part, and then the day before was an all-day conference on this subject. And these kinds of things are going on along the coast. So when you do go, say, Manzanita, they have a very strong group, about 100 people, and they're dedicated. They have, each person is in a group of a sector of, you know, one guy does, I mean, I'll say it, he does poop. And he's managing, he's the plan for the waste, and it's going to be an issue. Then there are the medical team, and we actually had legislation, and this is the part that takes so much time, that it's slow in building this paradigm, but the retired doctors, for example, there are a lot of retired doctors and healthcare folks who want to help, and because of the liability issues, et cetera, they were worried about, you know, providing medical assistance and care during a disaster like this. So we tweaked the law a little bit so that it would help that facilitate that particular piece. Same with engineers. You need engineers. I mean, I'm sure there are engineers in the room here of some sort. And my son's an engineer, and he works at a water and wastewater treatment facility or agency. And they are busy now retrofitting their tanks and things like that if they haven't already done it. But and then that gets into all the work that needs to be done that we will find come out of this plan when the two-pager I told you about, the report that came to the legislature of the recommendations from this plan that need to happen sooner than later. And so I've introduced three bills. They're not in yet, but I've put them in, submitted them for drafting, and they're coming out rather vague because they're called placeholder bills. But therefore, when the legislature then reviews this and acts on the recommendations or not, but we're going to be positive and know that they will. And so it's, I feel personally responsible to let my colleagues know, all 89 of them down there, how important this is and what they can do to help implement this plan. And it's, you know, right down to, we know we can't get the whole thing done in 2 years or even in the next 6 months, but this is a 50-year, where we want to be in 50 years, and we realize it's a work in progress. And I know that she's going to come to us probably 6 months from now and say, you know those maps we gave you? Well, we've done some more research. But that's good, because that means that it's happening and people are keeping up. And it's, I look at it as, you know, the glass half full. We know it's going to happen, we just don't know when. And so I'd rather be prepared for it and then it doesn't happen. But the final thing I want to say about all the stuff that's in here, almost everything that's going to be recommended represents jobs. And so while we're getting prepared, we're employing our, you know, people who live in these areas and around the state. And think of all the jobs that will be for retrofitting buildings. So we're going to be recommending, and Senator Courtney, bless his heart, he's been such a champion here. He's introducing a bill to up the amount of bonding for the upgrades from $30 million per biennium to $200 billion, excuse me. Gosh, that B just came out, didn't it? I wish. But that's going to be a steep hill to climb, but with the kind of activities that are going on and proving the kind of economic boost to communities, right down to manufacturing. And think of all the building, I'm thinking of upgrades for buildings, schools, hospitals, firehouses, police stations, all the public buildings. And there are businesses that are starting around this. So that's the good news. And hopefully we'll be prepared, and when it happens, we will have some fatalities and we will have a lot of devastation, et cetera. But another thing that is helping this whole effort is all the renewable energy stuff that we were going to do anyway. And that's what we need on the coast, is a source of power because we're going to be cut off from the rest of you in the inland. So that's not a negative thing to end on, because then that gets us to help do our part, you know, for the greenhouse gas issue. And she talked about climate change, and that's something very serious we need to address, although Oregon is pretty clean. But I think that there are a lot of goods in this too. And so I will say today that I'm dedicated to doing all I can to help forward this effort and get us on track and get us prepared. And my biggest fear is that Dr. McConnell will come and say, you know, I'm going to retire next year. So hopefully you won't. Anyway, thank you for allowing me to speak today, and make sure you look this up. It's interesting reading, and I can't leave this with you because these were very dear. Only a few were printed, and that's another of my jobs, is to find some funding so we can print and have one in every library in our state. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll break for a few minutes so members can form their questions and table discussions can take place. Thank you.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the October 10th City Club program, Oregon's Geology. Scientists warn of hazard, but do lawmakers and agencies respond? With Dr. Vicki McConnell and Deborah Boone. Thank you.
I'm Paul Thompson, a City Club member on and off for the last decade. Thank you for coming today. In a way, you're kind of preaching to the choir. We have our emergency generator. I've been involved with the Amateur Radio Emergency Service to provide communications. We have our stash of cash and so on. But let's auger in for a second on the Cascadia event. And I'm not going to ask you whether you can predict it's going to occur a week from Tuesday or not. But I would like to ask you to be specific about Eugene. Give us some words about what the extent of damage will be predicted to be in Eugene, and where we can go to get definitive information, maybe maps or something that show the different regions, what they're susceptible to, and so on, so we can do more intelligent planning.
I think that's Representative Boone's question, correct? thank you. And good question, and you're right, absolutely. I don't predict, I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't even forecast when it comes to something. We don't have the science available to forecast precisely when you're going to have a seismic event. We look at the history over time, we look at the science of it, we do monitoring, and then we can give you probabilities, and that's what you hear about a lot, and that there's the probability. So for the Cascade Subduction Zone earthquake, which is part of our earthquake off of the coast, that has the capacity to be anything from 8.2 to a 9.0 plus, which is what they call the big ones. So there will be damage here. There'll be damage all through the state, certainly mostly on the west side of the Cascades. You'll still have severe shaking here. Buildings that are not rehabilitated or built after the late 80s or early 90s that have not been built to proper seismic standards won't do well. Your older unreinforced masonry buildings will not do well. They're going to have to withstand shaking in the strong to severe air level for maybe 2 minutes or more. You have liquefiable soils here, which means that those soils are not particularly stable in shaking, so that if you have your bridges and your infrastructure that are built in those type of soils, that tends to be a lot where you have floodplains or where you have fill, then your stability of that particular foundation or structure doesn't do well either. So certainly it won't be as bad as on the coast. Certainly you won't have a tsunami, but certainly you will have damage here. You also have a lot of issues with co-seismic earthquakes. coastal seismic landslides because you have a lot of hills here. You can go to www.oregongeology.org and go to our HazView map, type in your address, and it'll show you what your hazards are. We have a whole menu of hazards, and you can look at what the severities are there.
And then another thing to think about, since you are inland, is you'll have company. People from the coast will move inland. We used to joke with Representative Jensen from Pendleton and say, you know, if it happens during Roundup, make sure you know I'm staying with you. And that happens anyway, though. But people will be moving inland, upland, inland from the coast, and so you should be prepared for that as well.
Dan Solis, City Club since 2009. Thank you for coming today. My question concerns the nuclear aspect of the spent fuel in dry cast at St. Helena. Will a tsunami get up there? If we have the earthquakes, how will that affect the tank farms in Hanford and the spent fuel pool at the Northwest Generating Station, a little ways from the tank farms there in Hanford? Is the plan discussing that or thinking about that at all, that radioactivity getting into the Columbia? Or?
I can't answer you definitively or directly because I just frankly don't know. I know Hanford is required to be looking at worst-case scenarios for all the planning that they're definitely aware of both the Cascadia, and they have issues with crustal earthquakes that are right there that they need to also be planning for. But we know what Hanford is. It's remediating a site from a very long time ago. And so although they're building that into their planning, I certainly could not say what the safety factor is.
And then the spent fuel and dry cast at St. Helena, will the tsunami get up that far?
No. I don't believe they'll have the kind of issues that you would have directly, I mean, right on the coastline.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You mentioned tanks, so since the tanks in Portland, along Linton area, that's a real concern because they are on liquefiable soil, and their supports are. I've seen some pictures, and not much more than a little, you know, concrete thing.
What's the chances of moving those up the hill?
Sorry?
What's the chances of moving those tanks up the hill?
Well, and that's a problem. That was a question we had in OSPAC, and they're privately owned, and the company's response was basically they hold about 4 days worth of fuel, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the word we got was they're privately owned, they don't need to be there, so there's not, right now there wasn't any interest in retrofitting them, but I think we're going to have that other discussion again on that, because that, if you think about what would happen if those tanks are full and it goes into the river, what that does, A, to the river, plus all the fuel, but not to mention the metal and everything else. So thank you for the question.
Jerry Smith, City Club member since 2002. Fracking, a minor change in Earth's equilibrium, caused earthquakes in the Midwest. What might the rapidly melting glaciers and the rapidly warming oceans due to the equilibrium of Earth's plates and volcanism?
Definitely for you. Definitely for her.
Well, there's a lot of science and basic research going on about that right now, and I won't opine, but there's certainly, if over time, or when over time we see melting, particularly of the glaciers, then that there will be changes in that weight. Both the melting of the glaciers lets the sea level rise, which changes the equilibrium on the coast, but it also allows for some changes in the plate tectonics as well, because those particular continents will rise. The big picture of what will happen is things will change, and it'll be on a geographic time scale.
Susan Connolly, City Club member since 2008, even though my husband thinks it's 2009. thank you both for coming. My question is, I understand that Red Cross is doing, and has done for a long time, some really good work around disaster preparedness and perhaps in particular earthquakes recently. Can you address that as to what kind of information they might have or share some of the information with our audience?
Well, they were at the table from the beginning, and they have since changed people, but we're very lucky to have the people we have on board now, too. But they've been part of this whole process. They've helped develop the plan, and I don't purport to know everything that they do, but they're right up there, and they have all the same information. And I don't know, I've never been through a disaster myself, but they will, and it's a great segue into the what has come out of this plan and going through all this over the last couple of years. This is more about systems and structures and things like that, and the piece that was just part of it, there was just a small part of it, was the socioeconomic effects and impacts. And so we've decided that we, meaning the task force, that's now no longer a task force, but we're recommending that it be reincarnated to do a second plan that would be for the human side. And so that's where I think the Red Cross will elevate to probably that level of, I can't see on the radio, I'm pointing to Dr. McConnell. And having the experts in the human side, in the because one of the things that was brought up is we have, right now, we are not quite up to snuff with our mental health system. Think about what would happen with that, just that one sector, in an emergency like this, and how long-lived it will be. I mean, one of the things that really struck me was the business continuity group came up with the time frame of how long can someone be without their, or they're having their business closed before they give it up. And it wasn't very long at all. It wasn't even a month. I think it was 2 to 3 weeks. And so we have to think about that. And one of the top recommendations was then getting systems back up for example, electricity, getting that back up, getting buildings reopened if they're okay to be reopened, and getting people back to work as soon as possible and back to normal as soon as possible, because normal is going to be a whole new thing. But that was a big deal, and that's my big push with renewable energy, too, as well as just it's a good thing to have because it's clean and renewable and all that. But it's going to be what we're going to use those kinds of devices that we can put in the ocean, put in rivers, solar, whatever. Solar is going to have to be rebuilt, I'm sure, in some cases. Yeah. Windmills, things like that, offshore wind. We need direct power to our coastline communities. And then we'll need, for the folks in the valley, they're going to have to rebuild their transmission systems. And everybody's, all the utilities, everybody's on board. Everybody knows this is coming, and they're working on it. And just to long answer and kind of outside of your whole realm of question, but every state agency has been required and does have a plan. So for their agency and for their operations. So the state's on board. I know that the cities and counties do the same. In Clatsop County, for example, our emergency management team is connected with very closely to the military, too. So, and they're the ones, the National Guard are our champions in all this, too. And then, and somebody mentioned it, I think one of the guys who just spoke said the ham radio people, they were the saviors in our big storm at the coast. And all these things are going to be part of our getting it back together, but they're all human connected. So I think our next plan will be less structural and technical and more humanistic.
I'm Robin Fletcher, and I've been a member since 2004. And I have two questions. One, will you repeat the website address so that where you can look up your address for hazard?
This is Vicki. I forgot we were told to identify ourselves for the radio, so I apologize we hadn't been doing that. The Eugene City Club is going to have links to Oregon Geology website and to OEM where you can view the everything. So that's your easiest way to do it. www.oregongeology.org will get you right to our website, and you can then look at some of our interactive maps there as well.
Thank you.
And the state site's www.oregon.gov, and then you can go to Oregon Military Department and Oregon Emergency Management and or Dogami, and they all have copies of these things on them.
Thank you. We were talking about earthquakes in schools, and we were wondering what the timetable is for retrofitting Oregon's schools, and where are we in the process?
Well, we have a program, and it's got a long name, but it's basically the Seismic Safety Grants Program, and they have, right now, they're working off of a $30 million per biennium, so $15 million a year program, and it's a grant program, and people apply for these grants, and then they're vetted, and there's always, like any grant application, and they try to make them as simple as possible, but there's always more demand than there is money. But that was what I was mentioning. The good news is Senator Courtney is going to be promoting a much higher level of funding. And if you'll recall, about 10 years ago, the people of Oregon voted to do just this at the level of $2.1 billion, and I get to say it now, that is the billion level, to bond to that level for seismic retrofits to public buildings, including schools. That would, if we could do that, that would be fabulous, because then we could just start cranking them out. Right now it's competitive in that sense, but not all the grants are very high, and not all the fixes are that in depth. You know, some of them are and some aren't, but that's a goal, and Dogami did a, I don't know how in depth, but you can talk about that, what assessment, but that's an ongoing process too.
Yeah, I'll just say real quickly in that, we released a report, this is Vicki, in 2007 called the Seismic Needs Assessment that looked at public schools and emergency facilities and a high-level visual, a rapid visual screening of their vulnerability. And out of 3,000 buildings that we looked at, approximately a third of those are in the height of very high risk of collapse, and most of those are schools, of course. And so at $20 million a biennium and nearly 1,000 buildings to look at to either replace or rehabilitate, that's going to take a while.
But replacement wouldn't fall within the grants program.
Clay Stevens, City Club member since 2013. I'm asking a question on behalf of a non-member from my table. Our question is regarding dams in Oregon. Assuming the dams can withstand the initial earthquake or disaster, has it been studied the debris after going down and hitting the dam? Will it be able to survive that impact? And has that been studied at all?
You get that one.
Rep Boone?
No, I have okay. One in my district that terrifies people.
This is Vicki. Dam safety and dam engineering is a little outside of my scope, so I'm not going to say, again, I know that has been seriously looked at, particularly on the big dams. If you're looking at the Willamette and the Columbia River dams, those types of engineerings are factored into it. The thing is, you never know exactly what's going to come flowing down. I mean, you just can't know. So there's always quite a bit of level of uncertainty, I'd say, in that. Smaller dams, earthen dams, the ones that are not designed as well are probably not going to fare as well, but a lot of those won't have as much debris on those as well. So that's definitely an area that needs, I think, more study and more reporting on it.
And we've done a little bit of work on debris from the tsunami over in Japan and following it across the ocean. And they're looking right now. I mean, this is another outreach plea. If you're on the beach and you see one of those what are they, like a tube of some sort? Anyway, they are looking for those. If you pick one of those up, turn it in. It'll tell you what to do on it, because that's measuring how long it takes. They sent them off from Japan, measures how long it took to get there, and of course it was 2 years ago, so now we know. But the debris issue is huge, and talking to the team from Japan who came over here last year, and we met in Cannon Beach, and we took them all around the area, and they said that is a huge issue, because you can just imagine, and I know in landslides the same thing, the amount, the number of, if it's landslide, it's mud pretty much, mud and trees and things, but the number of truckloads and where do you put it and, you know, things like that. But the debris that comes in on the ocean and it comes in and if you saw the films from Japan, you saw how bad that was. And I'm sure that we'll have stuff just like that here from on the coast. But as far as dams inland, just what Dr. McConnell said, rocks, trees, etc., and that all is trouble.
Hi, I'm Josh Bruce. I'm a former City Club member, mid-2000s. It's nice to be back. And Dr. McConnell and Representative Boone, thanks for being here. As you know, I know your work, and it's extremely important, and you're both to be commended for your leadership. In the interest of full disclosure, I do run the Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience here at the University of Oregon. And we were talking about local policy issues at our table. So the challenge of the best time to mitigate is really when you're building new buildings in terms of where you site those and how you construct them. Can you talk a little bit about sort of building public buildings to earthquake standards? Right now, a lot of the times, those are options, you know, for building managers that they consider at the end. Are there possibilities that policies can be adopted to make sure that building strums from the beginning are in place?
I can answer that really fast mm-hmm. and say yes, and then I can turn over the detail work to Dr. McConnell.
Well, okay. I can answer this. This is Vicki. I can answer that in a couple of ways. You're right. So public buildings and commercial buildings have a seismic standard that they have to be built to that's built into the building codes. If it's an emergency facility or a building that needs to be still usable after, say, a seismic event, then it has to be built to that level. Excuse me. If it isn't necessarily considered something that is vital, then it's usually built to what's called life safety, which means you can get the people out of the building, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to use it afterwards. Those are policy discussions that have to be discussed, and you have to come to a decision on that at a state or local level about what are those levels you're going to require your buildings and your different types of buildings to be built to. And of course, residential has a different code because they're residential. The other part of that is the land use part of it and your zoning part, and where do you identify where you have areas that are just too hazardous, or you maybe the mitigation takes too much work to do that, or it must require mitigation. And so those are policy issues that have to be discussed too.
I think that if it involves the public and or even an office building or something like that, I think you're going to see a little more activity there. But again, private residents, you can't really mandate that. You would hope people who spend that much money to build a home would want it to stand.
Mary Layton, City Club member since 2006. Our table had a question. How do government agencies at different levels coordinate their responses with local people? You talked a little bit about Red Cross. One of our newest organizational members is Food for Lane County. And they have some resources that they're investing in emergency preparedness. So what is because there won't be phones, apparently. How do they organize?
You know, and that was more down into the weeds than I got with my activities with the plan. But I know it's being done in the coastal communities, that's the only ones I can speak for. I know that they have regular meetings and everybody's invited to the table, all the different levels of government. And we have somebody in the back who used to be in the federal world and is now in the state world. You'll find these people at these meetings. They get notices, and what they do is they make their plans and they rehash them, et cetera, so that people know what to do. It's just kind of like a volunteer fire department, which I served on for 16 years. And you drill every week, and it's the same stuff usually, but at different permutations. And then when the big one happens, as far as a fire department, it could be a bus or a log truck accident or something like that where we live. Or who knows, a plane crash, and you just kind of fall into what you're supposed to do, and people know what to do. Plus the issue of the ham radios again. That's something that we've done with some of our volunteers, is saying, you know, you might not be able to haul a hose or use the whole Matro tools, but you could probably pick up a little radio. They're like that big. They're as big as a cell phone. And use your ham radio. I don't know if it's ham anymore, but you know what they call it. But those are the lifeblood between people, and they will be the relays. Radio stations, another thing. A couple of radio stations who are heavily involved serve as the communications center, et cetera. But I just remember in the storm of 2007 in our area, the sat phones that everybody was touting didn't work. So just didn't. It was the ham radios, it was the local people being on these little teams and knew what to do. And then we were talking about this early with Randy. Here's a good spot to throw this in. Identifying your local neighborhood, so mapping your neighborhood, those kinds of programs. We did that along the coast early on, and it became a real tool for volunteer fire departments, et cetera. Didn't have to be a tsunami or a earthquake or anything, but people, in the case of a big fire or something, if they know that two people in that house or three people on this street need assistance getting out of their house and moving somewhere, they can go right there. They don't have to wait to get called. And so they're very valuable, and it also helps you know your neighbors and kind of keep track of each other. And on a human level, that's not a bad thing either.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Flynn. I'm a member through the Wayne Morse Center's sponsorship, mm-hmm. and this has to be quick because apparently we are out of time. But I had assumed that there is an early warning system in Oregon that will give us all 2 minutes warning or something like that to get ourselves prepared and out of the house. We have a professor from the U of O at the table who said that is not the case, or we are not as prepared as California and Washington. So I'm curious, and we as a table are curious, can you comment on the role of the state in supporting development of a earthquake monitoring system? And it's got to be quick.
Right. Okay. So just real quick. Yeah. So there is a monitoring system, the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, but it is not an early warning system. However, OSPAC, that was mentioned earlier, the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council, has decided to take on that very question to convene a policy discussion on how Oregon is going to fit themselves into earthquake early warning, which is both a federal mandate and is very an interest in California, Oregon, and Washington. So those policy work are starting to happen. And the research is also happening as we speak.
And just recently at one of our interim committee meetings of the Emergency Prep and Veterans Committee hearing, your own Nancy Nathanson, state representative from North Eugene, I think, area, Steve's here, and Doug Toomey, who's here somewhere.
He's hiding behind the podium.
He's over there. Came to the committee and pitched to the state to buy some tools that were going to be sent somewhere else, some NOAA tools, and made their case, and we're going to carry that forward. So we'll get.
Thank you very much, Vicki McConnell and Deborah Boone, for bringing clarity and vision to this complicated topic of Oregon's geology. Scientists warn of hazards, but do lawmakers and agencies respond? Thanks again to our sponsors, Network Charter School, Hearing Associates, and KLCC. We have a double bill coming up next week that I need to tell you about. On Wednesday evening, October 15th, City Club and the League of Women Voters will sponsor a debate for the 4th U.S. Congressional District with candidates Michael Bielstein and Art Robinson and incumbent Peter DeFazio. This is a free public forum, but seating is very limited. Members can find out more and request tickets by calling or emailing the City Club of Eugene. And then on Friday, October 17th, we'll meet again here at the Downtown Athletic Club for Measure 86, Will the Oregon Opportunity Initiative Improve Access to Higher Education? Our guest speakers will be Ted Wheeler, Oregon State Treasurer, and Bob Brew, Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Thank you so much for being with us today.